I'll be talking about history as future. That's what I think the Zhuozhuan is. It is history written from the perspective of what's going to happen. So in this presentation in particular, I analyze the system of timeliness in Rishu or day books and in the Zhuozhuan in order to demonstrate the relationship between prognosticating and history writing. I choose day books because they constitute one of the earliest products of the ideas about time. As manuals meant to help people plan their future according to hemerological prognostications, day books put into practice the belief that time, understood as the course of nature, determines people's fortunes and misfortunes. As I will demonstrate, the system of timeliness in historiography is related to the mantic concept of time that can be observed in day books. It is the occult practices that constitute the backbone of concepts of morality and which spur the idea of the omenological and didactic functions of history writing. Zhishu or day books, translated as almanacs or day books, is a generic term used to denote hemerological materials and magic formulae from the Warring States period. The term originates from a manuscript excavated in 1975 on a site at Shuihuti in Yunmeng in Hubei province. So for my analysis, I am going to consider two documents. One is Zhishu from the Shuihuti collection, and the other one is Chu Silk manuscript from Zidang Ku. Even though both of these are contemporaneous day books that conform to the same hemerological principles and present the same worldview, namely that time possesses certain predetermined qualities, it is either good or bad for certain actions, they focus on two different aspects of the nature and working of time. One is purely secular and pragmatic, the other religious and moralistic. The function of a day book or an almanac is to advise whether a given day is auspicious or inauspicious for a certain kind of activity and for a particular kind of person. The prognostications in day books are based on a fixed system in which time figures as an agent. Time is in itself good or bad, and it determines the course of events on a given day. Every undertaking is either timely or untimely, and the day book advances the information regarding that. So a typical day book prognostication provides a list of activities that one can or cannot do on a particular day. And of course, it could be, here's an example, it could be a day, but it could be a different period of time. It could be a month, or it could be a week, or it could be, you could have a, you know, you could have a particular activity and then days or weeks when it's good or not good to do those activities. So here we have a typical example. It tells you on a specific day what is auspicious and what is not auspicious. Not all prognostications are very detailed. Some are rather general. For example, here we see that on this particular day, one cannot do anything. And but many prognostications are very deterministic, indicating that in case of A, B will inevitably occur. For example, here, you cannot travel, and if someone does attempt to run away, he will certainly be captured and delivered to the authorities. So if A happens, then B will inevitably happen too. The prescriptions in the almanacs may appear dogmatic or irrefutable, but only in form, not in contents. They are not injunctions. People do not have to obey them. Zhishu does not foster any moral obligation to follow the prescriptions. In fact, any kind of activity can be successful as long as it happens at the right time. I have a few examples here. You'll see that, you know, small and great things can be accomplished, fair and foul alike come to completion of themselves, or it is auspicious to take revenge, make military attacks, lay siege, begin killing. Or, for example, all affairs are inauspicious. All affairs inauspicious. One can intercept people on the road, for example. So if you read through a day book, you also see days when it's good to run out of jail, or when it's good to intercept people or kill or take revenge or steal. You know, so those events can be really of any kind. So as we can see, Rishi Shu serves everybody impartially and inadvertently. Values and ethics are not an issue when prognosticating. People who know how to use the system of timeliness can be successful in any kind of undertaking. The True Silk Manuscript, the other document that I want to consider today, is slightly older than Rishi Shu, than this one. But the worldview it reveals is more elaborate. In fact, as for the dating, you know, the exact dating of Rishi Shu cannot be precisely determined, but we can consider Rishi Shu and the True Silk Manuscript to be contemporaneous. They are coming from the same region and they belong more or less to the same tradition. So in the True Silk Manuscript, time has a religious nature and it carries a moral charge. Months and seasons are personified as gods and require worship, and a failure to observe proper timing results in punishment. At first glance, these prognostications in the True Silk Manuscript are very similar to those found in Rishi Shu. For example, here we have the first month. It is a similar prognostication, just by the way, the translation is by Professor Cook, who is present. So you can do certain things and not other things. But, on the other hand, the document admonishes people to observe the calendar and respect the time gods with proper sacrifices, otherwise they should be punished. Here's the longer text from the document, and I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it shows you that, you know, it is an admonition. It says that a calendar needs to be observed, and I put it in bold, be attentive and respectful in your preparations. Respect it without fail. So, as we can see, the True Silk Manuscript is not just a handy manual helping people to choose a good day to do something or to avoid a bad day. Instead, the True Silk Manuscript admonishes people to observe the calendar and perform the timely ritual in order to avoid calamity. It is noteworthy that the True Silk Manuscript also endorses the law of timeliness by applying historical narrative. The document narrates the history of the calendar, the knowledge of which is the key to predicting the future. This written history is presented for the sake of future generations to be used by them and to be continued. Moreover, the historical narrative spells out the moral code underlying the system. It warns that disobedience to time results in catastrophe. In effect, historical account instructs and serves as a warning. Compared to Rishi Shu, the True Silk Manuscript starts from the same point, but it takes the agenda of timeliness a step further. As in Rishi Shu, the working of time is mechanistic, but in addition to that, in the True Silk Manuscript, disobeying time bears a moral charge. As I am going to demonstrate now, when adopted by other areas, in particular by historiography, the concepts about time intrinsic to daybooks develop into a more sophisticated moral system of timeliness. They initiate the conceptualization of time in terms of right and wrong. To present the mechanism of timeliness in the Zhuozhuan, I will analyze the story of Duke Wen of Jin, and I will demonstrate that history writing was considered the practical application of the faculty of Ming, which I translate as sage illumination, which is closely tied to the principle of timeliness, Shi. It implies the ability to distinguish between the right and the wrong time, things that are seasonable or not seasonable, timely, untimely, that is Shi and Pu Shi. I offer an interpretation of early Chinese historiography not so much as a record of events, but as a means of meting out punishments and rewards based on the moral system of timeliness. I showed that the Zhuozhuan, rather than just narrating the past, reveals and reproduces the very mechanism of time that underlies and shapes the narrated events. In this way, early Chinese historiographical writing offers its readers a lesson about the correct discernment of situations, characters, and events. Being an illuminated person, or a sage, in short, means understanding how time works and acting in accordance with it. The narrative shows that time endorses the law of punishments and rewards. They will be meted out correctly in their due time. The ability to know the correct time acquires a moral quality. A timely or untimely action is tantamount to right and wrong. The Zhuozhuan explains the fates of the protagonists, or whom I call actors, by applying this moral code based on timeliness. There are three ways in which the Zhuozhuan achieves this. The presence of prognostications in the text, in the narrative, they expose the working of the actor's fate. Then through paradox or anomaly, it draws the reader's attention to the existence of a moral problem or conflict by showing how the paradox unfurls and gets solved over time. The narrative assures the reader that the law of justice never fails. And then the last one is the use of the spirit world, which I use to avoid the term supernatural because it's problematic. This is the transformation of humans into ghosts and vice versa that brings justice to work in a timely manner. First, though, let me present the structure of the narrative. In the Zhuozhuan, there's interplay between the roles of the narrator, who, as the storyteller, is the voice of the authors of the text, and then the prognosticators or advisors, who are the mouthpieces of the narrator within the story and who provide a reverse perspective by interpreting and commenting on the events and by foretelling their outcomes. Basically, the prognosticators are in the narrative and they always predict things that are going to happen. They are never wrong. And then the last one is the actors or the protagonists, who are the so-called historical figures whose life stories are being presented in the narrative by both the narrator and the prognosticators. And then there are two perspectives. One is the perspective of the omen reader or the prognosticator looking towards the future, and that of the writer of history, the narrator, looking towards the past, that produced the relationship between omen reading and history writing. In the Duke Wen story, which I'm going to consider, the Duke Wen story unfolds on two levels. The narrative has two different modes of temporal progression, each corresponding to a different point of view. There's the chronological level, which is the narrative, where the events are unfolding progressively towards the future. This is the domain of the prognosticators and the actors. This is what is going on chronologically. And then there's the historical level, which I call the supranarrative, where the story is completed and perceived in retrospect as history. Here, the narrator solves puzzles and explains paradoxes. Actors, who have sage illumination, know that final justice will be served by history in the supranarrative, by the way certain individuals will be remembered by future generations. In other words, they are aware of their own historicity. I'm talking about the narrative, inside the narrative. So let me begin by telling you what the story is about, the story of Duke Wen of Jin, what actually happened. So we are in the state of Jin in the 7th century BCE. As Professor Cook said, the Zhuozhuan was probably written around the 3rd century, but of course it tells the history, it tells the past. It's known as the earliest written Chinese history, as the earliest historical narrative known extant in Chinese tradition. So, but here we, in this story, in this particular story, we are back in the 7th century BCE in the state of Jin. And the story has three main characters, actors, the three sons of Duke Xian of Jin, Shen Sheng, Chong Er, and Yi Wu. Their father, Duke Xian, also marries a young lady who very soon becomes his favorite concubine. She wants to establish her own son as a successor to the throne, so she drives Shen Sheng, the oldest son, into a suicide and the other two into exile. After the death of Duke Xian, Chong Er, the second son remaining, attempts to return and take the throne as Duke Wen. However, his younger brother Yi Wu manages to snatch the throne and becomes Duke Hui instead. Chong Er remains in exile for 19 years. In the meantime, Yi Wu becomes an exemplarily bad ruler in Jin. After his death, Chong Er returns to Jin as Duke Wen. The king of Zhou officially declares him the hegemon of the states. Pa. Summarizing, Chong Er is the hero of the story. The narrative is about his way to hegemony. Shen Sheng is the martyr. He is the legitimate heir apparent in Jin, and it is through his sacrifice that the hero may succeed to the throne. Lastly, Yi Wu is the villain. He is the imposter who obstructs the way of the hero. The narrative does not only present these events in a chronological way, but also informs the readers about the logic underlying them. Thus, it reveals the mechanism according to which history works, why things happen in a certain way. Now let me discuss what happens to the three brothers in the narrative, how the fates are presented and explained. The first of the brothers, Shenshen, is a virtuous man, but he meets a bad end. Shenshen is the legitimate heir in Jin. However, through the agency of prognosticators, people, usually ministers or officers who comment upon events and pass their judgment and foretell the outcomes, so through their agency, the reader knows ahead of time that Shenshen will never become a ruler. There are three main prognostications, each one showing how his father, Duke Xian, intentionally abuses the timely sequence of transition by prematurely appointing Shenshen to offices. For example, he becomes an army commander ahead of his due time. He also sends Shenshen to war in a wrong season. One of the prognosticators points out that the Duke wants to doom his son by manipulating time. In his interpretation, the prognosticator emphasizes that the time or season is what allows a certain kind of activity. Duke Xian is sending his son to war too late in the year. So here again, I have the text. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it starts from the point that the season is the icon of an activity. And then it says here, I put it in bold, that the Duke, the father, impedes the actions of his son by means of the season that he picks for the campaign. Finally, we can see Shensheng's end. The concubine slanders him of attempting to poison Duke Xian. Shensheng takes his own life. He could escape, but he chooses to die as a martyr of virtue and filial piety. The prognosticators reveal Shensheng's conflict with time, and at the same time, they also pass a moral judgment on him. They evaluate him as a person. His untimeliness is not his doing. Therefore, they present him as a positive character and as a man who has been wronged. Thus, the prognostications make the reader face a paradoxical situation. How do we explain this undeserved fate? The prognosticators declare Shensheng an innocent scapegoat, and the criticism is aimed at his father, Duke Xian. They compare Shensheng to Taipo, a man of antiquity and a paragon of moral virtue, who renounced the throne in favor of his youngest brother. By thus aligning Shensheng with an archetype, the minister prognosticator is taking Shensheng out of the chronological flow of history and by extension away from his own doom. Shensheng belongs to a different time and place. If Shensheng is Taipo, then his fate is his own moral choice. Shensheng understands that he's not the right person of the time. He's yielding the throne to his younger brother Chung Er. He could escape his physical doom. However, he follows the advice of the prognosticator and understands that a sacrifice like that of Taipo, which allows the timely ruler to come, is morally more desirable. Therefore, the injustice he suffers is not a doom, but a necessary and conscious sacrifice for the hero Chung Er, later Duke Wan. Shensheng is a virtuous man, but he suffers injustice. This paradoxical situation disturbs the reader's sense of justice and makes it seem as if the general law of punishments and rewards had failed. However, as the situation unfurls, it confirms this law and shows that it never fails. The logic and rationale that the narrative fosters is timeliness, which is not within the capacity of the actor to decide, but it is for him to know and to follow. Shensheng embraces his fate and does not act against time. He works in Chung Er's favor, thus allowing the timely coming of the hero when justice will be served and when his own reward is due. In the case of Shensheng's second brother, Yi Wu, the question is why an evil man seems to be successful. He keeps the throne in Jin and dies a natural death. All the accounts of the events concerning Yi Wu have the same narrative structure. They consist of the historical account itself, a report of what happened, and a commentary, which invariably is a prediction of Yi Wu's imminent doom. I'm talking about the second brother who took over, the youngest brother who took over instead of Chung Er. He snatched the throne from his elder brother. So Thus, no single entry in the whole narrative covering the affairs in Jin during the period of his rule that would not serve as a pretext to criticize him and to foretell his future. This is a narrative device, and the result is a narrative according to which Yiwu only commits transgressions and ignores all the warnings and good advice. Finally, the prognosticated doom does come. Yiwu provokes a war with Qin, is defeated in the battle of Han, and taken captive. However, all this amounts to another paradox. Yiwu is not finished, but instead he is restored in Jin and able to continue as Duke Hui until his natural death. Again, the reader's sense of justice is disturbed. There's a certain opacity about Yiwu's doom, which seems mediocre and incomplete. When debating, because Yiwu was taken captive by the Earl of Qin, when debating what to do with him, the Earl of Qin decides it is not yet time to finish him off. He says, "I resent Jin's ruler, but I do sympathize with its people. Besides, I heard that when Tang Shu was in fifth, the Viscount of Qi said, his descendants will surely flourish. How then would I be able to annex Jin? For the moment, I shall cultivate my virtue and wait for a capable man to arise in Jin." This text, this is again, Yiwu is captive. He lost the battle. His doom has come. But the guy who keeps him captive, the Earl of Qin of the neighboring state, he says, "Okay, let me restore him. Let me not give him another chance. I have no hopes for him. But I heard a prognostication. I heard a prophecy or prognostication earlier that says that this is not yet time, that there will be another ruler in Jin who's going to come. And of course, he knows who that other ruler is going to be. So clearly, the Earl of Qin respects the predictions and has a strong notion of timeliness. He adjusts his actions to heaven's design. He does not take advantage of his power because he knows the future. He understands that there's a right moment for each action and that acting against time would be futile. As the text indicates, the law of justice is suspended, but justice will be served in the right time. Indeed, Yiwu's real doom is yet to come. After his restoration, there are no accounts in the Zhuozhuan on the affairs in Jin until his death. The absence of narrative constitutes a part of the portrait of Yiwu. It is also important for a correct understanding of the nature and significance of his doom. Negative prognostications indicate that this is not Yiwu's time to be the ruler. He appropriated this time from someone else. He stole it, and he'll be punished. The prognostications expose him as a usurper and evoke the anticipation of Duke Wen of Chung'er. The execution of the punishment is not instantaneous, but put away in time. Yiwu is given the time to prove himself wrong. Just as Chung'er needs time to come as a hero, Yiwu, too, needs time to enact his doom. Chung'er, on the other hand, how can he come back after 19 years and be a sage ruler? Characteristically, the narrative covering the rule of Yiwu in Jin begins with a reference to Chung'er. The text refers to him, to Chung'er, as Duke Wen, instead of calling him by his name, Chung'er, as if he actually had become the successor of Duke Xian, installed on the throne, and the legitimate ruler of Jin. However, Yiwu ousts Chung'er before he is installed, and Chung'er does not become Duke Wen until 19 years later. Before then, he's only known as Chung'er. So the narrative calls him his name, Duke Wen, 19 years before he actually becomes Duke Wen. This proleptic phrasing used in the narrative is a deliberate choice. It reveals to the reader the events that are going to take place in the future. Referring to Chung'er as Duke Wen determines the way the reader perceives Yiwu, undermining in narrative terms the position, his position as Duke Hui. From now on, he will be regarded as a temporary ruler. The real ruler is waiting for his time, and his story is pending. Therefore, Yiwu's return to Jin after the Battle of Han and the captivity in Qin is not a success. He does not redeem his name and position. He is restored through the agency of someone else, just for the time being. Yiwu's fate is no longer in his hands, and it is not in his power to change his status. He has no future. Hence, there are no further accounts and no predictions concerning him. His story is over, and his doom is sealed. The future, the time, and the story belong to Duke Wen, who will come in the due time. So actually, the story about Yiwu is actually the story about Chung'er, not about Yiwu, the main character. Shensheng suffers, to summarize a little, Shensheng suffers a temporary injustice, but he gains in the end. He is the moral winner. He heeds good advice, understands the working of time and the imminence of justice. He can read the future. Shensheng has the sagely illumination, just like the sage Tai Po, to whom he is compared. He is rewarded by history in the supernarrative with the name of a virtuous man. Yiwu occupies the throne of Jin and dies a natural death. He temporarily wins, but he loses his future. Yiwu does not heed advice, he ignores the prognostications, and he acts against time. Finally, he is portrayed as the counterexample of a sage. He is quite literally erased from history. His son, who is installed before Chung'er takes over, is killed. Yiwu has no posterity, no continuation, no future, such as his final doom and punishment. As for Chung'er, it takes him 19 years to return and take over the throne as Duke Wen, and the time of his absence fully counts. It is the fact of being away itself that is crucial for his comeback as a hero, and that determines his performance when he is at power in Jin. Unlike in the cases of Shensheng and Yiwu, Chung'er's actions are never commented upon, and he is offered no advice. All the prognostications concerning him are about him and not for him. They prepare his return as Duke Wen. Thus, the final and most important paradox is solved. The answer to the question why it takes Chung'er 19 years to return is timeliness. He needs to return at the right time. The delaying factor is an important component. The hero must not only come at the right time, he also needs time to come. It takes time to become a hero. Without the delay, the story of Duke Wen would not be complete. The contrast with Yiwu would not become evident, and Chung'er would not be missed. Consequently, the reader would not recognize him as a hero, and his return would lack its solving and fulfilling quality. Thus, it is the time itself that makes Chung'er into a hero. It is because of the suspense that it is evident to the reader that Chung'er is Duke Wen before, after, and during, or despite his absence. Thus, by means of prognostications, the narrative explains why Shensheng does not get the throne. In case of Yiwu, prognostications are used to present him as an illegitimate ruler and by contrast to endorse Chung'er. As for Chung'er, they enable and justify his return after such a long period of absence. The prognostications show that in the due time, justice is always served. Now, as I pointed out before, Shensheng and Yiwu get rewarded and punished, respectively, by history in the supernarrative. However, the punishments and rewards are also meted out quite directly in the chronological narrative. The narrative accomplishes that by applying the spirit world. One of the first decisions of Yiwu after usurping the throne as Duke Hui is reinterring the body of Shensheng. Shensheng committed suicide outside of the capital, so Yiwu decided to transport his body, to disinter it, transport it from the place where he committed suicide back to the capital. In this way, Yiwu wants to be identified with his martyred brother. He appropriates Shensheng's sacrifice in order to legitimize his own claims to the throne. So that, of course, outrages Shensheng. Shensheng cannot, he's so outraged, he comes back in the autumn of the same year. Shensheng comes back as a ghost to punish Yiwu for his transgressions. The execution of the punishment is not instantaneous, but put away in time. He predicts Yiwu's doom. Shensheng deems Yiwu unworthy, and despite being dead, he reclaims his position as the heir apparent and puts himself in charge of Jin. He says, I'm back as a ghost, I am the heir apparent, and I am the real ruler, and I oust this guy who is a usurper. The ghost predicts the battle of Han and the doom of Yiwu. On the other hand, the final execution of justice comes with the return of Chong'er. After the death of Yiwu, Yiwu's son takes over as Liu Kuai. And the first command of the new ruler is that nobody must follow the fugitive. And the fugitive, by the fugitive, here I have the Chinese text, Wang Zhan refers to Chong'er. This word choice has an emphatic function. It reveals the perception of Chong'er and defines his status. A fugitive, Wang Zhan, is someone who has departed, who left the boundaries or limits of a certain domain, like a state. By extension, it is someone who is no more. It's a dead person. So the Shensheng's return episode fits perfectly into the logic of the narrative. It satisfies the reader's expectation and presents the wrong person himself executing justice. Likewise, the reader is prepared for the comeback of Chong'er and therefore knows immediately who the nameless fugitive is. So Shensheng returns after his death. Yiwu's life is spared after the Battle of Han, but politically, narratologically, and historiographically, he's dead. There are no accounts on his final years on the Jin throne. Also, he's left with no posterity. And finally, Chong'er's silent presence overshadows the narrative, and he becomes a legend while still alive. He returns as a ghost coming back to life, and a myth coming true. Indeed, both Shensheng and Chong'er return as punitive ghosts. There's a category of punitive ghosts or enlightened ghosts, Mingkui. The ghosts endowed with sagely illumination and therefore able to discern right from wrong in order to mete out punishments and rewards. So here again, Chong'er, when he returns, he is presented in the text as a dead person coming back, as if it was a ghost, not a human being. Duke Wen begins his rule, Chong'er, when he comes back. He starts his rule with punishing all the traitors and rewarding the faithful. He exercises power by appointing virtuous men, defending weaker states, and teaching and transforming the people by exposing them to the example of himself. He goes down in history as a great hero, one of the five hegemons, Ba, a virtuous and illuminated ruler, Ming Jun, and compared to the sage kings of antiquity. This is what happens when Chong'er resumes the throne as Duke Wen in Jin. Now, day books are written pronouncements of prognosticators Zhizhe, who knew and understood the nature of time and therefore were able to foretell the future. In the Zhizhe worldview, time determines people's lives profoundly, forcing them to follow the calendar and adjust their activities to its course. On the other hand, however, time's regularity and predictability puts people in control and leaves a lot of room for manipulation. This vision of time is fatalistic only in the sense that a person cannot make a day good or lucky. It is possible, however, to plan the future by picking a lucky day and suitably matching activities to the proper day. The relationship between humans and the cosmos is not entirely mutual, but the mechanistic nature of time renders it predictable and thus conquerable. The Zhishu, as a transcription of the course of time, is a tool for manipulating time fate. One's fate depends on the timeliness of one's actions. An actor can choose to act in a timely or untimely manner. For example, Shensheng and Yiwu. Shensheng chose to act in a timely manner and Yiwu against the timely manner. One can also manipulate fate, like Duke Xian, who deliberately changes Shensheng's fate by means of timeliness. He sends him to battle in a wrong season, he appoints him to offices at the wrong time. In this way, time and fate become interdependent. As daybooks promise, correct application of the mechanism of timeliness ensures success and good fortune. The Zhizhe, through the daybooks, provided people with solutions in everyday life. Professor Li Ling from Beijing University draws a straight line connecting the Zhizhe with the historiographer's Shi. This term Shi is very complex, but one way of translating it just as a working tool is historiographers. In Professor Li Ling's opinion, both groups of officers The Zhizhe and the Shi belong to the same tradition stemming from the court calendar specialists Zhi Guan or Zhi Yu. The historiographers derived the ideas about the working of time from the same source as the authors of almanacs, and they write history applying the system of prediction based on timeliness. The Zhuozhuan ends with the capture of the unicorn, the mythical portent of the returning golden age. The people who catch this weird animal do not recognize it, so they mishandle it. The Lin, as the unicorn is called, is killed. Then Confucius comes along. This is all from the narrative in the Zhuozhuan. Confucius comes along, he recognizes the mythical animal, and he understands the implications of its coming. According to the Chunqiu commentary tradition, Confucius deems the coming of the unicorn untimely and decides to compose historical annals through which he explains what led to this occurrence. He understands his task of studying and representing the past as looking for the manifestations of Ming, the sagely illumination, and the criterion that he applies to his search is timeliness, Shi. By recognizing the unicorn and justifying its fate, Confucius reveals himself as a sage. He not only calls the unicorn by its proper name, but he recognizes it as a portent. He sees what otherwise would go unnoticed. Without Confucius, we wouldn't know the unicorn ever came. The narrator in the Zhuozhuan is like Confucius. He looks back at history and explains the events. By writing history and evaluating right and wrong, he metes out punishments and rewards. Historical narrative is not focused on what happened in the past, but on what will happen in the future. History is the omen of future events. By learning and understanding the past, we can predict the future. As we saw in the story of Duke Wen of Jin, the prognosticators, the actors, and ultimately the narrator articulate themselves through the mechanism of time. To know the time is important. It does not matter so much that the unicorn's coming was untimely. What matters is that Confucius the sage reveals himself by demonstrating his ability to recognize this untimeliness, the fact that it was untimely. The one who does it is the master of the narrative, which means this person can determine if an actor in the past was good or bad, morally. The temporal structure of the Zhuozhuan narrative is not just an abstract organizational principle, but the very canvas on which the story is written. It carries with it a particular moral system. Timely and untimely action correspond with morally charged concepts of right and wrong. In other words, a person can only be considered virtuous if his actions are executed at the right time. Therefore, and this is key, the ability to see if the time is right, the quality of sagely illumination, is the most important of all qualities. An untimely action, no matter how well-intentioned, cannot be successful. A truly virtuous person understands that and therefore waits for the suitable moment to act. In effect, then, time or timeliness emerges as the prime agent that determines the course of history. It imposes limits on the actors who need to adjust their actions accordingly. Consequently, timeliness influences or sure influences a person's fate. But from the all-important perspective of history or the supernarrative, what matters is the moral choice and wisdom of the actors as they try to see whether they should act or not. A Ming or illuminated person, a sage person, understands the workings of time and knows that acting against it is both futile and immoral. The actor's fate depends entirely on the moral choices he makes. These have to be Ming or sagely illuminated. They must be based on the recognition of the right timing. It is by being Ming or not that the actor positions himself in history. The story lives after the speaker dies. Both Shen Sheng and Chong Er are aware of their historicity, of their own historicity. They consciously negotiate and create their historical profiles to represent them in the future. Shen Sheng dies actually and Chong Er figuratively for the sake of winning life in the memory of the posterity. Yu, on the other hand, unaware of being a historical figure, acts against time and is wiped off the historical record. The rhetorical transformation of a human into a non-human corresponds with the supranarratological metamorphosis of an individual into a historical figure, immortalized through a historical record. The study of individual biographies from this perspective reveals how the Zhuozhuan establishes the relationship between people and time. An untimely and thus improper action disturbs the course of nature and leads to complications and anomalies. As I pointed out previously, by the example of the True Silk Manuscript, humans are tied to nature in that all the activities are regulated by the calendar, whose operation is ritualistic. It is because of this that all transgressions result in grave consequences. In other words, an inappropriate action will be avenged not necessarily by those who were directly affected by it, but by the larger force lying behind the main principle, which is time. The narrative is not a warning, but it reflects this principle, and it does serve as a moral guidance. According to the tradition, Confucius compiled the annals, Chunqiu annals, in order to condemn the wicked and praise the virtuous. This is a quote. Therefore, he exposed the bare acts without commentary in a written historical record. The commentators viewed these annals, Chunqiu annals, as history speaking for itself. In the Zhuozhuan, through the portraits of the actors, the narrator conveys the message that their position in history, the history's judgment, is not accidental. This is especially visible in cases of injustice when virtue seems to go unrewarded and wickedness unpunished. It is then that the narrator's questioning comes into play, and when he discloses the moral law of rewards and punishments based on the understanding of timeliness. In his storytelling, the narrator is restricted to a degree by the historical course of real events and by the historical facts or what really happened, so to speak. However, it becomes clear that his real job is not merely to report what occurred in the past, which he cannot change, but to explain its apparent paradoxes, situations when the law of punishments and rewards does not seem to have been working. Prognostication exposes the working of the actor's fate. By planting prognosticators in the plot, the narrator breaks the boundaries and limitations of chronological time and realizes the efficacy of the illumination meaning, of the sagely illumination. Justice will be served in the due time. Paradox draws the reader's attention to the existence of a moral problem or conflict. Then, by showing how the paradox unfurls and is resolved over time, the narrative assures the reader that the law of justice never fails. The spirit world is applied to foreground the punitive aspect of sagely illumination and signals its divine origins. The wrong actors assume the role of illuminated ghosts in order to execute the justice. In effect, their own illumination is revealed. The Zhuo tradition, the Zhuozhuan, does not explicitly pronounce the law by which punishments and rewards are based on timeliness, but it can be considered an illustration and even a product of it. The concept of sagely illumination is the key to implementing this law and at the same time exposing it. In Ming, in sagely illumination, inheres the ability to mete out punishments and rewards in a just manner, and its standard derives from an accurate understanding of timeliness. Illumination is at the same time both the servant of justice and the means by which justice is served. The exercise implies discerning. Its exercise implies discerning the distinction between right and wrong, and knowing the time when justice is to be executed. Now, to summarize really quickly, the idea is that the narrator metes out punishments and rewards by evaluating the actors in retrospect and assigning them a place in history. He is able to correctly read the past. That's his function. The prognosticators do the same by always pronouncing the right judgment and predicting the fates of the actors. They are able to see the future. And the actors practice their illumination, their being sages, or the lack thereof, in the narratives here and now by making moral choices between right and wrong. The hero is an illuminated actor, and a Mingjin, an illuminated ruler, is a ruler who quite literally punishes the wicked, rewards the virtuous, and whose government depends on good advice. In the Analects, there's this line, 时然后言,然不厌其言. I apply this to myself right now. Only speak at the right time, and nobody will have enough of what you say. So if you had enough of what I said, that means the time is over. So one who gets to tell his story is the master of time. Just like Confucius. Thank you.